الان 6 يبرز البلد، تشيع الشهداء يبرز البلد.
Early June 2011 sees scores of protesters and other members of the opposition rounded up, tortured, or killed. The largest protest to take place in the country thus far. I know we say that a lot. The largest protest to take place in the country thus far ends up provoking the largest manhunt to take place thus far. You've got tanks and soldiers in Hama. They're shooting people, they're arresting people, they're causing all kinds of mayhem and terror. You've got mass arrests in the capital city, Damascus, which is unfortunately a predictable outcome given the fact that the largest protest to take place thus far in Damascus had recently occurred. It makes sense that the regime's response would be particularly heavy-handed in the country's capital city. And there's also similar campaigns of arrests, torture, and killings going on all over the country, even in the smallest villages. We can see examples of this in a report issued by Amnesty International in early July 2011. I'm going to quote now a BBC article that quotes this particular report from Amnesty International. This is a BBC article titled, "Amnesty Accuses Syria of Crimes Against Humanity." This was published on July 6th, 2011. Quote, "Witnesses have told Amnesty International that Syrian security forces fired on fleeing families on May 14th, the day the army entered Tel Khalak near the Lebanese border, following a protest in the village calling for the downfall of the regime. At least one person, 24-year-old Ali al-Basha, was killed, apparently by snipers. And the ambulance carrying his body came under fire, witnesses said, by phone and in Lebanon. Amnesty International has not been allowed to enter Syria. In the following days, scores of male residents were rounded up and detained. Most were tortured, Amnesty says, some even as they were being arrested. In one incident, soldiers transporting detainees counted how many they had arrested by stabbing lit cigarettes on the back of their necks," Amnesty said in its report titled, "Crackdown in Syria, Terror in Tel Khalak." The report also highlights the case of a 20-year-old identified as Mahmoud, who says he was jailed for nearly a month, including 5 days at a detention center in Homs, where he was tied up in stress positions and tortured. "Each day was the same," he told researchers. "They tied me up in a shabwa position, strung up by the wrists and forced to stand on tiptoes, and applied electricity to my body and testicles. Sometimes I screamed very loudly and begged the interrogator to stop. He didn't care." Witnesses say that at least 9 people from Tel Khalak died while in custody. Their bodies showed signs of torture, including cuts to the chest, slashes on the thighs, and apparent gunshot wounds to the legs, Amnesty was told. Unquote. That was from a BBC article titled, "Amnesty International Accuses Syria of Crimes Against Humanity." Now, with the benefit of hindsight, we can look back on what we're about to talk about, and it's easy to get disappointed. It's easy to look back and say now, well, that didn't really lead to anything of substance. Honestly, you would be correct. But at the time when it started, it was a major inflection point. It was a major development in this story, and it appeared at the time to be a game changer for everybody involved, for better or worse. I'm talking about when the American and French ambassadors to Syria visited Hama on Friday, July 8th. Once again, we have another Friday. That's always when the biggest protests take place. Well, now, not only do we have, again, the largest protest to take place thus far all over the country, which seems to happen every single Friday at this point. In addition to that, we have, for the first time, ambassadors visiting these anti-government protests. We talked earlier about Turkey publicly criticizing Assad. The Turkish ambassador never did that. The American and French ambassadors visited Hama on Friday, July 8th, 2011. This day was dubbed by some activists the Friday of no dialogue. We're done with dialogue. We're done negotiating with the regime. We are calling for its downfall. Ashab yurid iskat an-nizam. And it's on this Friday that you see massive protests, not only in Hama, although those are the biggest of them, not only in Hama, but also all over the country. So let's take a look at what happened when the ambassadors went to Hama. We turn again now to Assad or We Burn the Country by Sam Daguerre. Quote, in Damascus, the French ambassador Chevalier met with fellow Western diplomats, including U.S. Ambassador Robert Ford, for lunch at the Italian embassy. Unquote. Okay, why am I not surprised they went to the Italian embassy for lunch? Now I'm just imagining them having like a wine and pasta lunch with espresso afterward. All right, back to the quote. Quote, Chevalier and Ford argued it was crucial to go to Hama. They wanted to use the freedom of movement they had as diplomats to assess the situation for themselves. Syria's foreign ministry had informed all diplomats that they must get permission for travel outside the capital. It wanted to restrict them to fact-finding trips that the ministry itself organized for them. Chevalier and Ford, however, felt that it was important to show solidarity with the large number of protesters in Hama who were coming under assault by the regime. Chevalier and Ford went separately to Hama. They contacted opposition activists in the city who found a way to get them in despite the large presence of regime forces, mainly on the southern and western sides. Unquote. Just a quick little bit of context. Yeah, so like these cities are oftentimes like, you got one neighborhood that's really pro-Assad, and then you got one neighborhood that's really pro-opposition. It's very rare that you have like an entire large city on the same page. Hama isn't entirely circled by the regime, but the areas where the opposition are the majority, they're under siege. Now back to the quote. Quote, on the night of July 7th, 2011, Ambassador Chevalier, a physician by training, made it to the Fida al-Harani Hospital, where many of the casualties had been taken. He was cheered by staff and patients. In the emergency ward, he met two teenagers who had suffered multiple gunshot wounds. As he came out of the hospital, he was met with more cheers and applause. Viva la France, shouted a crowd that had gathered outside. Unquote. I'm sorry for pausing the quote so many times. I just find it amazing that, like, in a country that had once been colonized by France, you now have Syrians chanting, Viva la France. You know Bashar screwed up in that some people are coming to prefer the French over him. Now back to the quote. Quote, people on motorbikes insisted on escorting his car to the Afamia al-Sham Hotel across the river. He passed through Asi Square, where protesters were determined to stay to defy the regime forces closing in on them. They set tires on fire and put other obstacles on the roads leading to the square to try to impede these forces. The protesters removed them briefly to let Chevalier's car through. The next day, heartened and feeling protected by the two ambassadors' presence, people gathered once more in large numbers in Asi Square. The next day, heartened and feeling protected by the two ambassadors' presence, people gathered once more in large numbers in Asi Square. Many welcomed the Western visitors with roses. Chevalier left, but Robert Ford stayed on a little bit longer and was mobbed by cheering crowds. Tell Ford he has 24 hours to apologize to the Syrian people because he breached diplomatic norms. Otherwise, I am storming the U.S. Embassy. Mohammed Jaber, who was working for Bashar's brother Maher, told prominent Damascene businessman Imad Grawati, whose brother headed the Syrian-American Business Council. No apology was forthcoming. Jaber and busloads of his men and regime loyalists, including some women, besieged both the American and French embassies. By then, Jaber was starting to organize his Shabiha thugs into what was called popular committees. Unquote. That's probably a misnomer. Now back to the quote. Quote, They gathered with posters of a smiling Bashar al-Assad dressed in a military uniform and flags of Syria and the Lebanese militia Hezbollah, one placard read. To whom it may concern, Syria is the resistance capital. Not a catchy slogan, gotta say. Maybe it sounds better in Arabic. Now back to the quote. The U.S. embassy is within walking distance from Bashar al-Assad's residence, and the French embassy is not far either. This was the capital's most secure area, bristling with armed agents protecting the perimeter of Bashar's compound. Nobody interfered when Jaber's men scaled the U.S. embassy's walls and attempted also to smash their way into the French embassy. They were turned back by guards at both sites, with those at the French embassy firing shots into the air. The exterior of both embassies was vandalized. The words, "Fuck off, America," was scrawled in red on the U.S. embassy wall. Unquote. That was an excerpt from Sam Daguerre's book, Assad or We Burn the Country. By the way, they also misspelled the words fuck and America. They left out the C. They also took out a syllable of America. Or at least that's what it looks like at first glance. A-M-R-I. Okay, they left out one of the E's. So I'm sorry, I know it's juvenile. Come on, it's funny. They misspelled fuck and America. That's funny. But yeah, so in immediate response to the U.S. and French ambassadors showing solidarity for protesters by visiting Hama, in the immediate aftermath of that, very, very quickly, you see not quite a state response, still a response from the regime. In this case, we see one of these rich people who kind of goes back and forth between being a businessman and being a politician, because that's how things work in a lot of countries. Through his own wealth and influence, gathers together this private militia, in a sense. It's a little bit like the Capitol insurrection, where you just get these people together in one place. They're not doing this for money. Well, okay, maybe in Syria in 2011, maybe they do it for money sometimes. In large part, it's an disorganized mob that, as counterintuitive as this may sound, has been organized for the express purpose of carrying out a state's will. And of course, they don't use soldiers for it. They use these crazy militia civilians in order to have plausible deniability. So Bashar al-Assad can say, no, I did not attack the U.S. and French embassies. Some civilians did it. It's just kind of a weird coincidence that they do that immediately after those ambassadors showed solidarity for people protesting against Bashar al-Assad. Yeah, come on. We're not stupid. Before we move on, I want to look at one more source examining what we've been talking about, but this looks at it from more so the Syrian point of view. That passage we read, Daguerre kind of focuses more so on the ambassadors and the outside perspective. Next, I want to read a couple of short passages from Samar Yazbek's memoir, A Woman in the Crossfire. This really gets more into the on-the-ground, inside perspective, basically how Syrians felt when all of this occurred. So Samar Yazbek, just a little bit of context, she is a journalist and author who took tons of great personal risks in 2011 to cover the revolution. This is from her memoir, A Woman in the Crossfire, Diary of the Syrian Revolution. Quote, "The French ambassador enters Hama and visits a hospital in order to make sure the wounded are receiving treatment. The American ambassador visits Hama as well, and the Syrian Foreign Ministry releases a statement voicing its distress over the visit, declaring that what the ambassador has done is contrary to diplomatic protocol. Syrian television says the ambassador met with agents provocateur in Hama and incited them to violence, while an American spokesman says the Syrian authorities were informed of the ambassador's visit to Hama. The Americans say that they support the Syrian people in their transition to democracy. It appears that the regime has failed to find a military or a political solution and has failed to garner the approval of the great powers. Today, there are 16 dead and scores wounded, some of them in Damascus. Washington decries the response of the Syrian authorities to the ambassador's visit, even as hundreds of thousands of Syrians pour into the Syrian squares. Say No to Dialogue Friday, or the Friday of No Dialogue, affirms that demonstrators do not want dialogue. Ambassador Robert Ford drives around among the protesters. The domestic opposition and the opposition abroad agree that there will be no dialogue. Hama is the epicenter of the protest movement. That was an excerpt from Samar Yazbek's memoir, A Woman in the Crossfire, Diaries of the Syrian Revolution. And yeah, I gotta be frank, I strongly doubt the regime did have prior notice that Ambassador Ford and Ambassador Chevalier were taking a road trip to Hama. I strongly doubt that because, number one, the regime would have tried to stop them. And number two, a couple years later, Robert Ford would say in an interview that was featured in the documentary Return to Homs, Robert Ford said that he didn't tell his superiors about this, which in plain English means he did not tell Secretary of State Hillary Clinton that he was going to Hama. And in his own words, he said he did not tell anyone he was going to do that because he did not want to run the risk that they would tell him, don't do it. So Friday, July 8th, 2011, the Friday of no dialogue, once again, we see the largest protest to take place in Syria thus far. We see that record being broken again for a third time in this episode. I want to reiterate that, again, Hama is where we are seeing the largest protest take place. But we are also seeing large-scale protests taking place in every major city, town, or even small village in Syria. For more on this, we turn again to Dr. Wendy Perlman's book, We Crossed a Bridge and It Trembled. First, she quotes a doctor from Homs named Karim. Quote, Fridays passed, and each demonstration was larger than the one the week before. If you came to Homs during the week, you'd think that life was normal. Stores were open, and people went to work. But the security forces had videos of the demonstrations and were arresting anyone who appeared in them. On Fridays, security forces filled the main square downtown and set up checkpoints to prevent people from getting there. In response, every neighborhood started launching its own protest. Even people who don't normally pray would come to the mosques just to participate in the protest. Everyone had this thirst to do something. There was confidence that we could overthrow the president by peaceful protest alone. Unquote. That was Karim, a doctor from Homs, quoted by Dr. Wendy Perlman in her book, We Crossed a Bridge and It Trembled. Now, Homs was another one of those cities that saw huge protests at this time, almost as big as Hama. Homs is the third largest city in Syria, and in particular, according to a guy that we interviewed on this show, a guy from Homs, Homs in particular stood out because, unlike most other cities, when protests would occur, stores would close on Fridays during the protest. Stores and restaurants and businesses would close, and ordinary people would come out in huge numbers to protest, very similar to what we're seeing in Hama at the moment. So that comment about how during the week businesses were open, you'd think things were normal, that's a really big juxtaposition from the protests occurring on Fridays. And also that thing he mentioned where people would go to the mosque even if they weren't religious, that is a phenomenon seen in a lot of cities in Syria, where oftentimes the protests will originate at a mosque. And even people who either aren't Muslim or aren't even religious, they ended up going to the mosques on Friday, possibly for the first time in their lives, so that they would be there when a protest starts so they could march alongside the protesters. Dr. Wendy Perlman documents such a scene when she quotes Ziad, another doctor from Homs. Quote, once a young man entered one of the mosques in Homs. You could see a necklace around his neck, but the rest was tucked inside of his shirt. He lined up and prayed with everyone else, and when he bowed, the necklace fell out. The pendant was a cross. People said to him, either you're wearing that necklace by mistake, or you came to the mosque by mistake. The Christian young man said, I came here to go out in the demonstration with all of you. Unquote. That was from an interview with Ziad, a doctor from Homs, conducted by Dr. Wendy Perlman for her book, We Crossed a Bridge and It Trembled. In addition to the 500,000 people protesting in Hama on Friday, July 8th, this day also sees protests in Damascus spread to the center of the city for the very first time. I know we've kind of been splitting hairs about Damascus and, oh, this is unprecedented. Oh, that is unprecedented. But yes, a series of unprecedented events have taken place in the capital city of Syria since March of 2011. So on July 8th, 2011, we see protests occurring in the center of the capital city of Syria for the very first time. And it's in direct response to this that security forces are filmed shooting protesters at close range. This has happened in a lot of other towns and cities across Syria, but this has never happened in Damascus before. It really begs the question, why? Why would people in Damascus or Aleppo or Latakia take such risks and protest so openly? Why would they do that? Those places aren't like Homs or Hama or Dara, where the opposition undoubtedly make up a majority of the population. As we've said multiple times in this episode and other episodes, Damascus, Aleppo, Latakia, those places are exceptionally dangerous for protesters. That is why, on July 8th, Syrian security forces were filmed shooting protesters at close range in Damascus. So why would people take this risk? What motivates these people to keep coming out and risk being shot or arrested or tortured? What motivates this? In order to answer this question, I want to turn now to another book. This is Burning Country, Syrians in Revolution and War by Robin Yasin Kassab and Leila Al-Shami. Quote, many Syrians speak of their first protest as a moment of personal liberation. Jolie, for instance, the engineering student from Homs. At first, I was scared to join in, but one day there was a very big demonstration which came from two directions, from the old part and the new part of Al-Wahir. And when I heard the chanting, the people want, and the singing, I started crying. Suddenly I was filled with courage and I picked myself up and walked out to join in. My mom tried to stop me, but I went anyway. It was a beautiful experience. I felt at last I was participating in the efforts to lift the oppression off us. Before that, I used to be scared to talk, even in front of my friends. I even cheered for Bashar at the university during his first speech at the People's Assembly. Can you imagine? It's something I regret very much now. And Yara Nasser, a Christian from Damascus. There was such a positive atmosphere. It sounds incredible, but suddenly everyone had good ethics. People stood together. Their slogans were very beautiful. Remember, this is a people who had been brainwashed and kept apart for decades, the victims of a failed education system, a failed social system. In this context, what the people did was amazing. I went down to Midan to protest. It's a conservative Muslim neighborhood, and I was wearing a skimpy top. One young man asked me, politely enough, to dress more appropriately when I came next. But his friend said, no, sister, you wear whatever you like. We're here for our freedom, after all. We were ready to transform into an open society. We had great momentum. Homs, though it is ancient Emissa, used to be a nondescript city beside an oil refinery, the butt of a thousand jokes. Unquote. A little bit like Detroit, kinda. Now back to the book, quote, now it was the capital of the revolution, a noble city to be praised and emulated. Competition and resentment between cities and regions was the old normality. Suddenly, people in one place were chanting their solidarity with others. O Homs, they sang, or Dara, or Banyas, or Derazor, we're with you until death. And Arabs learned the Kurdish word for freedom, Azadi. In an endless spiral, protests were met by gunfire, which led to funerals, which led to larger protests, which led to more funerals. Everybody on the streets now called for revolution, not reform. Protesters were seen raising their right hands to swear to continue the struggle until the regime was toppled, no matter what befell them. By attending protests and speaking out, hundreds of thousands of people had burned their bridges with a regime that brooked no dissent by principle and for reasons of survival. Millions were now committed to the system's destruction by peaceful means, if possible. What remained was to build an alternative. Unquote. That was from Burning Country, Syrians in Revolution and War, by Robin Yasin Kassab and Leila Al-Shami. I love how that quote so succinctly summarizes a process that I've been trying to describe for several episodes. We start off with protests calling for reform. They get oppressed. That leads to larger protests. The regime shoots protesters. That leads to funerals, which become protests. More people get shot, more funerals, more protests. This snowball effect that's been going on for months, from March of 2011 up till now in the story, July 2011. And it's such a great point that Yassin Kassab and Al-Shami made in that this regime tolerates no dissent at all. The moment you do, you're dead. Or you're at least going to get tortured for a long time and probably wish you were dead. So as a result, these hundreds of thousands, and now at this point, coming into July of 2011, we're starting to see the number of protesters starting to dip into the millions. That means there are now millions of people who live in a country where dissent is not tolerated, have now dissented publicly. And as we've said so many times before, anybody who openly dissents in Syria is punished more severely than for any other crime in the country. Just for comparison's sake, imagine if millions of people in China, maybe not a majority of the population, but a significant percentage, imagine if millions of Chinese citizens one day went out into the streets and then called for the Chinese Communist Party to be overthrown and for Taiwan to be the new government of China, that for the old Republic of China government to come back into the country. Imagine if millions of people in China went out into the streets and said, "We're done with the CCP, down with Xi Jinping." Imagine if that happened. How would the Chinese government respond to that? Those people going openly out into the streets to say that they don't like Xi Jinping, that they want to get rid of Xi Jinping and the Communist Party, they would disappear. Those people would get the Tiananmen Square treatment. And we can see a very similar phenomenon take place in Syria in 2011. We are now at a point where millions of people believe that their survival depends on Bashar al-Assad and others in his regime being removed from power. This is not simply a matter of, I don't like the government. This is not simply a matter of, I'd like to impeach the president and replace him with somebody better. This is life or death. And a lot of people are dying. The death toll is already well over 1,000. It's close to 2,000 at this point. We are in the thousands of deaths. And we're just at the very beginning. The regime sees what's going on, and they realize that their situation is getting more and more desperate day by day. For more on how they responded to this, I want to turn now to another book. This is actually a new book in our pantheon of sources. I haven't quoted this one before, from Shatter the Nations by Mike Giglio. Quote, "The crackdowns had become deadlier and the protests had spread. Bashar al-Assad tried to rally his supporters by inflaming sectarian tensions that dated to the division of Islam between Sunni and Shia in the year 600 CE. Assad and the core of his regime were Alawites, a religious minority in Syria combining some Christian and ancient Zoroastrian beliefs with the tenets of Shia Islam and broadly identifying as Shia. Assad peddled conspiracy theories that Sunnis planned to massacre minorities, and his security forces fired live rounds and sometimes artillery into the protests, hoping to overshadow their message of peace. At the same time, Assad released hardline Sunni Islamists en masse from the extremist breeding grounds of the regime's prisons to aid his claims about Sunni radicalism." Unquote. That was from Mike Giglio's book, Shatter the Nations. One thing that we are going to see over and over again in future episodes is that the regime really is more threatened by peaceful protesters than by armed opposition. So that's why the regime is incentivized to create a situation where the peaceful protesters are reliant upon an armed opposition for their very survival. It might sound counterintuitive. Why do peaceful protesters threaten the regime more so than armed rebels? Well, Look at all the neighboring countries. Look at all the governments that were toppled in 2011, mostly by peaceful protesters. It happened in Egypt. It happened in Tunisia. It's about to happen in Yemen. Bashar al-Assad sees all these revolutions going on, and he is terrified. On the other hand, this regime and the other ones that fell, you know, Egypt, for example, they had dealt with armed opposition before. They had dealt with violent extremists before. They had experience crushing those people. They were more comfortable dealing with a wartime situation than widespread, mostly peaceful protests. That's probably why around the same time in July 2011, you see the Ba'ath Party in Syria, the people who normally organize the pro-Assad rallies where you see huge groups of people gather in a city square holding pictures of Bashar al-Assad's face. Those people suddenly start organizing violent mobs to attack the American and French embassies, for example, after their ambassadors visited Hama. Increasingly, we're going to see more and more attempts by the regime to militarize this situation and provoke an all-out war for the sake of their own survival at the expense of their citizens' lives. The regime doesn't want to just openly do this, however. That's not the Assad family style. Instead, they are going to try to cloak the increasing crackdowns and provocation with half-hearted, actually that's an exaggeration, with downright disingenuous gestures toward reform, trying to say, okay, maybe we can talk about this. Maybe we can have some dialogue. And it's almost always going to end with the opposition getting screwed in one way or another. But after everything that's happened, when the regime has shown its true self in its ultra-violent moments, after having this happen so many times since March, by July, most people aren't buying it. That includes Syrians, and that also includes the American Secretary of State at that time, Hillary Clinton. All right, when it comes to the protests and revolutions in 2011, especially the ones that took place in the Middle East, whether it be Syria or, honestly, more controversially, Libya, Hillary Clinton's name gets brought up a lot, and usually it's not in a very flattering context. Sometimes it's very legitimate criticism. Sometimes it's just some plain old hysteria. Hillary Clinton being Hillary Clinton, the criticisms of her are about an even mix of the two, to be completely honest with you.
We came, we saw, he died.
Oof. Yeah. 10 years later, that comment is what young people today would call cringe. But Libya aside, and frankly, psychopathic jokes about Gaddafi's death aside, Hillary Clinton wasn't very focused on Syria in 2011, nowhere near as much as she was on Libya and Gaddafi. That might surprise a lot of people. You know, a lot of the pro-Assad propaganda paints her out to be some major player in the grand foreign conspiracy that led to the illusion of protests all over the country. I hope you realize that's bullshit at this point. The fact is, she had bigger things on her mind than Syria. Number one, she was trying to oust Gaddafi in Libya. Libya was one of her main priorities. As the American Secretary of State, as the head of American diplomacy and foreign policy, you got a lot of balls to juggle. In addition to her lobbying the U.S. to become more and more involved in the NATO intervention against Gaddafi in Libya, in addition to that, she also had all the normal routine matters of statecraft that a Secretary of State has to deal with. That's why in March of 2011, she explicitly stated that the U.S. is not going to intervene in NATO. There's just not enough clear information about what's going on. We don't really know who's killing who. We just call upon all sides to stop killing each other. The usual U.S. State Department, we don't want to do anything rhetoric. That was what she was saying in March of 2011. But by July of 2011, she ends up taking a different tune. And in large part, it is a reaction to the attack on the American and French embassies by pro-Assad mobs. I'm not saying this to defend Hillary Clinton. I have never made the case that Hillary Clinton was some moral, altruistic figure. I also don't think that she's the Antichrist, like some people paint her out to be, but, you know, whatever. Anyway, for better or worse, for good or evil, on July 11th, 2011, Hillary Clinton went on TV and almost publicly recanted what she said in March. Not so much an I was wrong, because of course Hillary Clinton wouldn't do that, but she did openly go out and publicly condemned the Assad regime, going as far as to say that Bashar al-Assad has lost legitimacy as the president of Syria.
The United States strongly condemns Syria's failure to protect diplomatic facilities in Damascus, including the American and French embassies and our ambassador's residence. As we have expressed directly to the Syrian government today, we demand that they meet their international responsibilities immediately to protect all diplomats and the property of all countries. The Assad regime will not succeed in deflecting the world's attention from the real story unfolding in Syria. This is not about America or France or any other country. This is about the legitimate aspirations of the Syrian people for dignity, universal rights, and the rule of law. Despite promising dialogue and promises of change, the Syrian government has responded to the people's peaceful protests with more violence, more arrests, and more intimidation. These assaults must stop. Neither the Syrian people nor the international community will accept half measures or lofty speeches. We call on the regime immediately to halt its campaign of violence, pull its security forces back from Hama and other cities, and allow the Syrian people to express their opinions freely so that a genuine transition to democracy can take place. Let me also add that if anyone, including President Assad, thinks that the United States is secretly hoping the regime will emerge from this turmoil to continue its brutality and repression, they are wrong. President Assad is not indispensable, and we have absolutely nothing invested in him remaining in power. Our goal is to see that the will of the Syrian people for a democratic transformation occurs.
From we don't want to get involved to this, to endorsing the opposition and saying that the U.S. has nothing invested in Bashar al-Assad remaining in power. Keep in mind, when the U.S. Secretary of State says, we have nothing invested in so-and-so remaining head of state of such-and-such country, when that happens, that person usually ends up out of power very soon. Bashar al-Assad now has reason to be very, very worried.